rapid intercuts, the video displayed a chilling victim's point of view account of the initiate's brutal murder. There were simulated blows to his head, including one with a mason's stone maul. All the while, a deacon mournfully told the story of the widow's son. Hiram Abiff, the master architect of King Solomon's temple, who chose to die rather than reveal the secret wisdom he possessed. The attack was mimed, of course, and yet its effect on camera was blood-curdling. After the death blow, the initiate, now dead to his former self, was lowered into his symbolic coffin, where his eyes were shut and his arms were crossed like those of a corpse. The Masonic brothers rose and mournfully circled his dead body, while a pipe organ played a march of the dead. The macabre scene was deeply disturbing, and it only got worse. As the men gathered around their slain brother, the hidden camera clearly displayed their faces. Langdon now realized that Solomon was not the only famous man in the room. One of the men peering down at the initiate in his coffin was on television almost daily. A prominent U.S. senator. Oh, God. The scene changed yet again. Outside now. Nighttime. The same jumpy video footage. The man was walking down a city street, strands of blonde hair blowing in front of the camera. Turning a corner. The camera angle lowering to something in the man's hand. A dollar bill. A close-up focusing on the Great Seal. The all-seeing eye. The unfinished pyramid. And then abruptly, pulling away to reveal a similar shape in the distance. A massive pyramidical building, with sloping sides rising to a truncated top. The house of the temple. A soul-deep dread swelled within him. The video kept moving, the man hurrying toward the building now, up the multi-tiered staircase, toward the giant bronze doors, between the 2 17-ton Sphinx guardians. A neophyte. Entering the pyramid of initiation. Darkness now. A powerful pipe organ played in the distance, and a new image materialized. The temple room. Langdon swallowed hard. On screen, the cavernous space was alive with electricity. Beneath the oculus, the black marble altar shone in the moonlight. Assembled around it, seated on hand-tooled pigskin chairs, awaited a somber council of distinguished 33rd-degree masons, present to bear witness. The video now panned across their faces with slow and deliberate intention. Langdon stared in horror. Although he had not seen this coming, what he was looking at made perfect sense. A gathering of the most decorated and accomplished masons in the most powerful city on Earth would logically include many influential and well-known individuals. Sure enough, seated around the altar adorned in their long silk gloves, Masonic aprons, and glistening jewels, were some of the country's most powerful men. 2 Supreme Court justices. The Secretary of Defense. The Speaker of the House. Langdon felt ill as the video continued panning across the faces of those in attendance. 3 prominent senators, including the Majority Leader. The Secretary of Homeland Security and the director of the CIA. Langdon wanted only to look away, but he could not. The scene was utterly mesmerizing, alarming even to him. In an instant, he had come to understand the source of Sato's anxiety and concern. Now, on screen, the shot dissolved into a single shocking image. A human skull filled with dark crimson liquid. The famed Caput Mortuum was being offered forth to the initiate by the slender hands of Peter Solomon, whose gold Masonic ring glinted in the candlelight. The red liquid was wine, and yet it shimmered like blood. The visual effect was frightful. The fifth libation, Langdon realized, having read first-hand accounts of this sacrament in John Quincy Adams' letters on the Masonic institution. Even so, to see it happen, to see it calmly witnessed by America's most powerful men. This was as arresting an image as any Langdon had ever seen. The initiate took the skull in his hands, his face reflected in the calm surface of the wine.
"May this wine I now drink become a deadly poison to me," he declared, should I ever knowingly or willfully violate my oath.
Obviously, this initiate had intended to violate his oath beyond all imagination. Langdon could barely get his mind around what would happen if this video were made public. No one would understand. The government would be thrown into upheaval. The airwaves would be filled with the voices of anti-Masonic groups, fundamentalists, and conspiracy theorists, spewing hatred and fear, launching a Puritan witch hunt all over again. The truth will be twisted, Langdon knew, as it always is with the Masons. The truth was that the Brotherhood's focus on death was in fact a bold celebration of life. Masonic ritual was designed to awaken the slumbering man inside, lifting him from his dark coffin of ignorance, raising him into the light, and giving him eyes to see. Only through the death experience could man fully understand his life experience. Only through the realization that his days on earth were finite could he grasp the importance of living those days with honor, integrity, and service to his fellow man. Masonic initiations were startling because they were meant to be transformative. Masonic vows were unforgiving because they were meant to be reminders that man's honor and his word were all he could take from this world. Masonic teachings were arcane because they were meant to be universal, taught through a common language of symbols and metaphors that transcended religions, cultures, and races, creating a unified, worldwide consciousness of brotherly love. For a brief instant, Langdon felt a glimmer of hope. He tried to assure himself that if this video were to leak out, the public would be open-minded and tolerant, realizing that all spiritual rituals included aspects that would seem frightening if taken out of context. Crucifixion reenactments, Jewish circumcision rites, Mormon baptisms of the dead, Catholic exorcisms, Islamic niqab, shamanic trance healing, the Jewish kaparot ceremony, even the eating of the figurative body and blood of Christ. I'm dreaming, Langdon knew. This video will create chaos. He could imagine what would happen if the prominent leaders of Russia or the Islamic world were seen in a video pressing knives to bare chests, swearing violent oaths, performing mock murders, lying in symbolic coffins, and drinking wine from a human skull. The global outcry would be instantaneous and overwhelming. God help us. On screen now, the initiate was raising the skull to his lips. He tipped it backward, draining the blood-red wine, sealing his oath. Then he lowered the skull and gazed out at the assembly around him. America's most powerful and trusted men gave contented nods of acceptance. "Welcome, brother," Peter Solomon said. As the image faded to black, Langdon realized he had stopped breathing. Without a word, Sato reached over, closed the briefcase, and lifted it off his lap. Langdon turned to her, trying to speak, but he could find no words. It didn't matter. Understanding was written all over his face. Sato was right. Tonight was a national security crisis of unimaginable proportions. Chapter 118. Dressed in his loincloth, Malach padded back and forth in front of Peter Solomon's wheelchair.
"Peter,"
he whispered, enjoying every moment of his captive's horror.
"You forgot you have a second family, your Masonic brothers, and I will destroy them too, unless you help me."
Solomon looked almost catatonic in the glow of the laptop sitting atop his thighs.
"Please,"
he finally stammered, glancing up. "If this video gets out..."
"If?"
Malach laughed.
"If it gets out?"
He motioned to the small cellular modem plugged into the side of his laptop.
"I'm connected to the world."
"You wouldn't."
"I will,"
Malach thought, enjoying Solomon's horror.
"You have the power to stop me,"
he said,
"and to save your sister. But you have to tell me what I want to know. The lost word is hidden somewhere, Peter, and I know this grid reveals exactly where to find it."
Peter glanced at the grid of symbols again, his eyes revealing nothing.
"Perhaps this will help to inspire you."
Malach reached over Peter's shoulders and hit a few keys on the laptop. An email program launched on the screen, and Peter stiffened visibly. The screen now displayed an email that Malak had queued earlier tonight, a video file addressed to a long list of major media networks. Malak smiled.
I think it's time we share. Don't you?
Don't! Malak reached down and clicked the send button on the program. Peter jerked against his bonds, trying unsuccessfully to knock the laptop to the floor.
Relax, Peter, Malak whispered. It's a massive file. It will take a few minutes to go out.
He pointed to the progress bar. Sending message, 2% complete.
If you tell me what I want to know, I'll stop the email, and nobody will ever see this.
Peter was ashen as the taskbar inched forward. Sending message, 4% complete. Malak now lifted the computer from Peter's lap and set it on one of the nearby pigskin chairs, turning the screen so the other man could watch the progress. Then he returned to Peter's side and laid the page of symbols in his lap.
The legends say the Masonic pyramid will unveil the lost word. This is the pyramid's final code. I believe you know how to read it.
Malak glanced over at the laptop. Sending message. 8% complete. Malak returned his eyes to Peter. Solomon was staring at him, his gray eyes blazing now with hatred.
Hate me, Malak thought. The greater the emotion, the more potent the energy that will be released when the ritual is completed.
At Langley, Nola Kay pressed the phone to her ear, barely able to hear Sato over the noise of the helicopter.
They said it's impossible to stop the file transfer, Nola shouted. To shut down local ISPs would take at least an hour, and if he's got access to a wireless provider, killing the ground-based internet won't stop him from sending it anyway.
Nowadays, stopping the flow of digital information had become nearly impossible. There were too many access routes to the internet. Between hard lines, Wi-Fi hotspots, cellular modems, sat phones, superphones, and email-equipped PDAs, the only way to isolate a potential data leak was by destroying the source machine.
I pulled the spec sheet on the UH-60 you're flying, Nola said, and it looks like you're equipped with EMP.
Electromagnetic pulse, or EMP guns, were now commonplace among law enforcement agencies, which used them primarily to stop car chases from a safe distance. By firing a highly concentrated pulse of electromagnetic radiation, an EMP gun could effectively fry the electronics of any device it targeted. Cars, cell phones, computers. According to Nola's spec sheet, the UH-60 had a chassis-mounted, laser-sighted, 6 gigahertz magnetron with a 50 decibel gain horn that yielded a 10 gigawatt pulse. Discharged directly at a laptop, the pulse would fry the computer's motherboard and instantly erase the hard drive.
EMP will be useless, Sato yelled back. Target is inside a stone building. No sight lines and thick EM shielding. Do you have any indication yet if the video has gone out?
Nola glanced at a second monitor, which was running a continuous search for breaking news stories about the Masons.
Not yet, ma'am, but if it goes public, we'll know within seconds.
Keep me posted.
Sato signed off. Langdon held his breath as the helicopter dropped from the sky toward DuPont Circle. A handful of pedestrians scattered as the aircraft descended through an opening in the trees and landed hard on the lawn just south of the famous two-tiered fountain designed by the same two men who created the Lincoln Memorial. 30 seconds later, Langdon was riding shotgun in a commandeered Lexus SUV, tearing up New Hampshire Avenue toward the House of the Temple. Peter Solomon was desperately trying to figure out what to do. All he could see in his mind were the images of Catherine bleeding in the basement and of the video he had just witnessed. He turned his head slowly toward the laptop on the pigskin chair several yards away. The progress bar was almost one-third of the way filled. Sending message, 29% complete. The tattooed man was now walking slow circles around the square altar, swinging a lit censer and chanting to himself. Thick puffs of white smoke swirled up toward the skylight. The man's eyes were wide now, and he seemed to be in a demonic trance. Peter turned his gaze to the ancient knife that sat waiting on the white silk cloth spread across the altar. Peter Solomon had no doubt that he would die in this temple tonight. The question was how to die. Would he find a way to save his sister and his brotherhood, or would his death be entirely in vain? He glanced down at the grid of symbols. When he had first laid eyes on the grid, the shock of the moment had blinded him, preventing his vision from piercing the veil of chaos to glimpse the startling truth. Now, however, the real significance of these symbols had become crystal clear to him. He had seen the grid in an entirely new light. Peter Solomon knew exactly what he needed to do. Taking a deep breath, he gazed up at the moon through the oculus above. Then he began to speak. All great truths are simple. Malach had learned that long ago. The solution that Peter Solomon was now explaining was so graceful and pure that Malach was sure that it could only be true. Incredibly, the solution to the pyramid's final code was far simpler than he had ever imagined. The last word was right before my eyes. In an instant, a bright ray of light pierced the murkiness of the history and myth surrounding the last word. As promised, the last word was indeed written in an ancient language and bore mystical power in every philosophy, religion, and science ever known to man. Alchemy, astrology, Kabbalah, Christianity, Buddhism, Rosicrucianism, Freemasonry, astronomy, physics, noetics. Standing now in this initiation chamber atop the great pyramid of Herodom, Malach gazed upon the treasure he had sought all these years, and he knew he could not have prepared himself more perfectly. Soon I am complete. The last word is found. In Kalorama Heights, a lone CIA agent stood amid a sea of garbage that he had dumped out of the trash bins that had been found in the garage. "Ms. Kay," he said, speaking to Sato's analyst on the phone. "Good thinking to search his garbage. I think I just found something." Inside the house, Catherine Solomon was feeling stronger with every passing moment. The infusion of lactated ringer's solution had successfully raised her blood pressure and quelled her throbbing headache. She was resting now, seated in the dining room, with explicit instructions to remain still. Her nerves felt frayed, and she was increasingly anxious for news about her brother.
"Where is everybody?"
The CIA's forensics team had not yet arrived, and the agent who had stayed behind was still off searching the premises. Bellamy had been sitting with her in the dining room, still wrapped in a foil blanket, but he too had wandered off to look for any information that might help the CIA save Peter. Unable to sit idly, Catherine pulled herself to her feet, teetered, and then inched slowly toward the living room. She found Bellamy in the study. The architect was standing at an open drawer, his back to her, apparently too engrossed in its contents to hear her enter. She walked up behind him.
"Warren?"
The old man lurched and turned, quickly shutting the drawer with his hip. His face was lined with shock and grief, his cheeks streaked with tears.
"What's wrong?"
She glanced down at the drawer.
"What is it?"
Bellamy seemed unable to speak. He had the look of a man who had just seen something he deeply wished he had not.
"What's in the drawer?"
she demanded. Bellamy's tear-filled eyes held hers for a long, sorrowful moment. Finally he spoke.
"You and I wondered why. Why this man seemed to hate your family."
Catherine's brow furrowed.
"Yes?"
"Well," Bellamy's voice caught, "I just found the answer."
Chapter 119. In the chamber at the top of the house of the temple, the one who called himself Malach stood before the great altar and gently massaged the virgin skin atop his head.
"Verbum significatium,"
he chanted in preparation.
"Verbum omnificum."
The final ingredient had been found at last. The most precious treasures are often the simplest. Above the altar, wisps of fragrant smoke now swirled, billowing up from the censer. The suffumigations ascended through the shaft of moonlight, clearing a channel skyward through which a liberated soul could travel freely. The time had come. Malach retrieved the vial of Peter's darkened blood and uncorked it. With his captive looking on, he dipped the nib of the crow's feather into the crimson tincture and raised it to the sacred circle of flesh atop his head. He paused a moment, thinking of how long he had waited for this night. His great transformation was finally at hand. When the last word is written on the mind of man, he is then ready to receive unimaginable power. Such was the ancient promise of apotheosis. So far, mankind had been unable to realize that promise, and Malach had done what he could to keep it that way. With a steady hand, Malach touched the nib of the feather to his skin. He needed no mirror, no assistance, only his sense of touch and his mind's eye. Slowly, meticulously, he began inscribing the last word inside the circular Ouroboros on his scalp. Peter Solomon looked on with an expression of horror. When Malach finished, he closed his eyes, set down the feather, and let the air out of his lungs entirely. For the first time in his life, he felt a sensation he had never known. "I am complete. I am at one." Malach had worked for years on the artifact that was his body. And now, as he neared his moment of final transformation, he could feel every line that had ever been inscribed on his flesh. "I am a true masterpiece, perfect and complete." "I gave you what you asked for," Peter's voice intruded. "Send help to Catherine and stop that file." Malach opened his eyes and smiled.
"You and I are not quite finished."
He turned to the altar and picked up the sacrificial knife, running his finger across the sleek iron blade.
"This ancient knife was commissioned by God," he said, "for use in a human sacrifice. You recognized it earlier, no?"
Solomon's gray eyes were like stone. "It is unique, and I've heard the legend."
"Legend? The account appears in Holy Scripture. You don't believe it's true?"
Peter just stared. Malach had spent a fortune locating and obtaining this artifact. Known as the Akeda knife, it had been crafted over 3,000 years ago from an iron meteorite that had fallen to earth.
Iron from heaven, as the early mystics called it.
It was believed to be the exact knife used by Abraham at the Akeda, the near sacrifice of his son Isaac on Mount Moriah, as depicted in Genesis. The knife's astounding history included possession by popes, Nazi mystics, European alchemists, and private collectors.
"They protected and admired it,"
Malach thought, "but none dared unleash its true power by using it for its real purpose. Tonight, the Akeda knife would fulfill its destiny." The Akeda had always been sacred in Masonic ritual. In the very first degree, Masons celebrated the most august gift ever offered to God, the submission of Abraham to the volitions of the Supreme Being by proffering Isaac, his firstborn. The weight of the blade felt exhilarating in Malach's hand as he crouched down and used the freshly sharpened knife to sever the ropes binding Peter to his wheelchair. The bonds fell to the floor. Peter Solomon winced in pain as he attempted to shift his cramped limbs.
"Why are you doing this to me? What do you think this will accomplish?"
"You, of all people, should understand,"
Malach replied.
"You study the ancient ways. You know that the power of the mysteries relies on sacrifice, on releasing a human soul from its body. It has been this way since the beginning."
"You know nothing of sacrifice," Peter said,
his voice seething with pain and loathing.
"Excellent," Malach thought. "Feed your hatred. It will only make this easier."
Malach's empty stomach growled as he paced before his captive.
"There is enormous power in the shedding of human blood. Everyone understood that, from the early Egyptians to the Celtic Druids, to the Chinese, to the Aztecs. There is magic in human sacrifice, but modern man has become weak, too fearful to make true offerings, too frail to give the life that is required for spiritual transformation. The ancient texts are clear, though. Only by offering what is most sacred can man access the ultimate power.
You consider me a sacred offering?
Malach now laughed out loud.
You really don't understand yet, do you?
Peter gave him an odd look.
Do you know why I have a deprivation tank in my home?
Malach placed his hands on his hips and flexed his elaborately decorated body, which was still covered only by a loincloth.
I have been practicing, preparing, anticipating the moment when I am only mind, when I am released from this mortal shell, when I have offered up this beautiful body to the gods in sacrifice. I am the precious one. I am the pure white lamb.
Peter's mouth fell open, but no words came out.
Yes, Peter, a man must offer to the gods that which he holds most dear, his purest white dove, his most precious and worthy offering. You are not precious to me. You are not a worthy offering.
Malach glared at him.
Don't you see? You are not the sacrifice, Peter. I am. Mine is the flesh that is the offering. I am the gift. Look at me. I have prepared, made myself worthy for my final journey. I am the gift.
Peter remained speechless.
The secret is how to die,
Malach now said.
Masons understand that.
He pointed to the altar.
You revere the ancient truths, and yet you are cowards. You understand the power of sacrifice, and yet you keep a safe distance from death, performing your mock murders and bloodless death rituals. Tonight, your symbolic altar will bear witness to its true power and its actual purpose.
Malach reached down and grasped Peter Solomon's left hand, pressing the handle of the Akeda knife into his palm. The left hand serves the darkness. This, too, had been planned. Peter would have no choice in the matter. Malach could fathom no sacrifice more potent and symbolic than one performed on this altar by this man with this knife, plunged into the heart of an offering whose mortal flesh was wrapped like a gift in a shroud of mystical symbols. With this offering of self, Malach would establish his rank in the hierarchy of demons. Darkness and blood were where the true power lay. The ancients knew this, the adepts choosing sides consistent with their individual natures. Malach had chosen sides wisely. Chaos was the natural law of the universe. Indifference was the engine of entropy. Man's apathy was the fertile ground in which the dark spirits tended their seeds.
I have served them, and they will receive me as a god.
Peter did not move. He simply stared down at the ancient knife gripped in his hand.
I will you,
Malach taunted.
I am a willing sacrifice. Your final role has been written. You will transform me. You will liberate me from my body. You will do this, or you will lose your sister and your brotherhood. You will truly be all alone.
He paused, smiling down at his captive.
Consider this your final punishment.
Peter's eyes rose slowly to meet Malach's. Killing you? A punishment? Do you think I will hesitate? You murdered my son, my mother, my entire family.
No!
Malach exploded with a force that startled even himself.
You are wrong. I did not murder your family. You did. It was you who made the choice to leave Zachary in prison. And from there the wheels were in motion. You killed your family, Peter, not me.
Peter's knuckles turned white, his fingers clenching the knife in rage.
You know nothing of why I left Zachary in prison.
I know everything,
Malach fired back.
I was there. You claimed you were trying to help him. Were you trying to help him when you offered him the choice between wealth or wisdom? Were you trying to help him when you gave him the ultimatum to join the Masons? What kind of father gives a child the choice between wealth or wisdom and expects him to know how to handle it? What kind of father leaves his own son in a prison instead of flying him home to safety?
Malach now moved in front of Peter
and crouched down, placing his tattooed face only inches from his face.
But most important, what kind of father can look his own son in the eyes, even after all these years, and not even recognize him?
Malak's words echoed for several seconds in the stone chamber. Then silence. In the abrupt stillness, Peter Solomon seemed to have been jolted from his trance. His face clouded now, with a visage of total incredulity.
Yes, father. It's me.
Malak had waited years for this moment, to take revenge on the man who had abandoned him, to stare into those gray eyes and speak the truth that had been buried all these years. Now the moment was here, and he spoke slowly, longing to watch the full weight of his words gradually crush Peter Solomon's soul.
You should be happy, father. Your prodigal son has returned.
Peter's face was now as pale as death. Malak savored every moment.
My own father made the decision to leave me in prison. And in that instant, I vowed that he had rejected me for the last time. I was no longer his son. Zachary Solomon ceased to exist.
Two glistening teardrops welled suddenly in his father's eyes, and Malak thought they were the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. Peter choked back tears, staring up at Malak's face, as if seeing him for the very first time.
All the warden wanted was money, Malak said, but you refused. It never occurred to you, though, that my money was just as green as yours. The warden did not care who paid him, only that he was paid. When I offered to pay him handsomely, he selected a sickly inmate about my size, dressed him in my clothes, and beat him beyond all recognition. The photos you saw, and the sealed casket you buried, they were not mine. They belonged to a stranger.
Peter's tear-streaked face contorted now with anguish and disbelief.
Oh, my God! Zachary!
Not anymore. When Zachary walked out of prison, he was transformed.
His adolescent physique and childlike face had drastically mutated when he flooded his young body with experimental growth hormones and steroids. Even his vocal cords had been ravaged, transforming his boyish voice into a permanent whisper.
Zachary became Andros. Andros became Malak. And tonight, Malak will become his greatest incarnation of all.
At that moment, in Kalorama Heights, Catherine Solomon stood over the open desk drawer and gazed down at what could only be described as a fetishist's collection of old newspaper articles and photographs.
"I don't understand," she said, turning to Bellamy. "This lunatic was obviously obsessed with my family, but..."
"Keep going," urged Bellamy,
taking a seat and still looking deeply shaken. Catherine dug deeper into the newspaper articles, every one of which related to the Solomon family. Peter's many successes, Catherine's research, their mother Isabel's terrible murder, Zachary Solomon's widely publicized drug use, incarceration, and brutal murder in a Turkish prison. The fixation this man had on the Solomon family was beyond fanatical, and yet Catherine saw nothing yet to suggest why. It was then that she saw the photographs. The first showed Zachary standing knee-deep in azure water on a beach dotted with whitewashed houses.
Greece?
The photo, she assumed, could have been taken only during Zach's freewheeling drug days in Europe. Strangely, though, Zach looked healthier than he did in the paparazzi shots of an emaciated kid partying with the drug crowd. He looked more fit, stronger somehow, more mature. Catherine never recalled him looking so healthy. Puzzled, she checked the date stamp on the photo.
But that's impossible.
The date was almost a full year after Zachary had died in prison. Suddenly, Catherine was flipping desperately through the stack. All of the photos were of Zachary Solomon, gradually getting older. The collection appeared to be some kind of pictorial autobiography chronicling a slow transformation. As the pictures progressed, Catherine saw a sudden and dramatic change. She looked on in horror as Zachary's body began mutating, his muscles bulging, and his facial features morphing from the obvious heavy use of steroids. His frame seemed to double in mass, and a haunting fierceness crept into his eyes.
I don't even recognize this man.
He looked nothing like Catherine's memories of her young nephew. When she reached a picture of him with a shaved head, she felt her knees begin to buckle. Then she saw a photo of his bare body, adorned with the first traces of tattoos. Her heart almost stopped.
Oh, my God.
Chapter 120.
Right turn, Langdon shouted from the back seat of the commandeered Lexus SUV. Simpkins swerved onto S Street and gunned the vehicle through a tree-lined residential neighborhood. As they neared the corner of 16th Street, the house of the temple rose like a mountain on the right. Simpkins stared up at the massive structure. It looked like someone had built a pyramid on top of Rome's Pantheon. He prepared to turn right on 16th, toward the front of the building.
Don't turn, Langdon ordered. Go straight. Stay on S.
Simpkins obeyed, driving alongside the east side of the building.
At 15th, Langdon said, turn right.
Simpkins followed his navigator, and moments later, Langdon had pointed out a nearly invisible, unpaved access road that bisected the gardens behind the house at the temple. Simpkins turned into the drive and gunned the Lexus toward the rear of the building.
Look,
Langdon said, pointing to the lone vehicle parked near the rear entrance. It was a large van.
They're here.
Simpkins parked the SUV and killed the engine. Quietly, everyone got out and prepared to move in. Simpkins stared up at the monolithic structure.
You say the temple room is at the top?
Langdon nodded, pointing all the way to the pinnacle of the building. That flat area on top of the pyramid is actually a skylight. Simpkins spun back to Langdon.
The temple room has a skylight?
Langdon gave him an odd look.
Of course. An oculus to heaven, directly above the altar.
The UH-60 sat idling at DuPont Circle. In the passenger seat, Sato gnawed at her fingernails, awaiting news from her team. Finally, Simpkins' voice crackled over the radio.
Director?
Sato here,
she barked.
We're entering the building, but I have some additional recon for you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Langdon just informed me that the room in which the target is most likely located has a very large skylight.
Sato considered the information for several seconds.
Understood. Thank you.
Simpkins signed off. Sato spit out a fingernail and turned to the pilot.
Take her up.
Chapter 121. Like any parent who had lost a child, Peter Solomon had often imagined how old his boy would be now, what he would look like, and what he would have become. Peter Solomon now had his answers. The massive, tattooed creature before him had begun life as a tiny, precious infant. Baby Zack curled up in a wicker bassinet, taking his first fumbling steps across Peter's study, learning to speak his first words. The fact that evil could spring from an innocent child in a loving family remained one of the paradoxes of the human soul. Peter had been forced to accept early on that although his own blood flowed in his son's veins, the heart pumping that blood was his son's own, unique and singular, as if randomly chosen from the universe.
My son, he killed my mother, my friend Robert Langdon, and possibly my sister.
An icy numbness flooded Peter's heart as he searched his son's eyes for any connection, anything familiar. The man's eyes, however, although gray like Peter's, were those of a total stranger, filled with a hatred and a vengefulness that were almost otherworldly.
Are you strong enough?
His son taunted, glancing at the Akeda knife gripped in Peter's hand.
Can you finish what you started all those years ago?
Son?
Solomon barely recognized his own voice.
I loved you.
Twice you tried to kill me. You abandoned me in prison. You shot me on Zack's bridge. Now finish it.
For an instant, Solomon felt like he was floating outside his own body. He no longer recognized himself. He was missing a hand, was totally bald,
dressed in a black robe, sitting in a wheelchair, and clutching an ancient knife.
"Finish it!"
the man shouted again, the tattoos on his naked chest rippling.
"Killing me is the only way you can save Catherine. The only way to save your brotherhood."
Solomon felt his gaze move to the laptop and cellular modem on the pigskin chair. Sending message. 92% complete. His mind could not shake the images of Catherine bleeding to death, or of his Masonic brothers.
"There is still time," the man whispered. "You know it's the only choice. Release me from my mortal shell."
"Please," Solomon said. "Don't do this."
"You did this,"
the man hissed.
"You forced your child to make an impossible choice. Do you remember that night? Wealth or wisdom? That was the night you pushed me away forever. But I've returned, Father, and tonight it is your turn to choose. Zachary or Catherine, which will it be? Will you kill your son to save your sister? Will you kill your son to save your brotherhood, your country? Or will you wait until it's too late, until Catherine is dead, until the video is public, until you must live the rest of your life knowing you could have stopped these tragedies? Time is running out. You know what must be done."
Peter's heart ached.
"You are not Zachary," he told himself. "Zachary died long, long ago. Whatever you are, and wherever you came from, you are not of me."
And although Peter Solomon did not believe his own words, he knew he had to make a choice. He was out of time.
"Find the grand staircase."
Robert Langdon dashed through darkened hallways, winding his way toward the center of the building. Turner Simpkins remained close on his heels. As Langdon had hoped, he burst out into the building's main atrium. Dominated by 8 Doric columns of green granite, the atrium looked like a hybrid sepulcher, Greco-Roman-Egyptian, with black marble statues, chandelier firebowls, Teutonic crosses, double-headed phoenix medallions, and sconces bearing the head of Hermes. Langdon turned and ran toward the sweeping marble staircase at the far end of the atrium.
"This leads directly to the temple room,"
he whispered, as the two men ascended as quickly and quietly as possible. On the first landing, Langdon came face to face with a bronze bust of Masonic luminary Albert Pike, along with the engraving of his most famous quote. "What we have done for ourselves alone dies with us. What we have done for others and the world remains and is immortal." Moloch had sensed a palpable shift in the atmosphere of the temple room, as if all the frustration and pain Peter Solomon had ever felt was now boiling to the surface, focusing itself like a laser on Moloch. "Yes, it is time." Peter Solomon had risen from his wheelchair and was standing now, facing the altar, gripping the knife.
"Save Catherine,"
Moloch coaxed, luring him toward the altar, backing up, and finally laying his own body down on the white shroud he had prepared.
"Do what you need to do."
As if moving through a nightmare, Peter inched forward. Moloch reclined fully now onto his back, gazing up through the oculus at the wintry moon.
"The secret is how to die."
This moment could not be any more perfect.
"Adorned with the last word of the ages, I offer myself by the left hand of my Father."
Moloch drew a deep breath.
"Receive me, demons, for this is my body which is offered for you."
Standing over Moloch, Peter Solomon was trembling. His tear-soaked eyes shone with desperation, indecision, anguish. He looked one last time toward the modem and laptop across the room.
"Make the choice," Moloch whispered. "Release me from my flesh. God wants this. You want this."
He laid his arms at his side and arched his chest forward, offering up his magnificent double-headed phoenix.
"Help me shed the body that clothes my soul."
Peter's tearful eyes seemed to be staring through Moloch now, not even seeing him.
"I killed your mother,"
Moloch whispered.
"I killed Robert Langdon. I'm murdering your sister. I'm destroying your brotherhood. Do what you have to do."
Peter Solomon's visage now contorted into a mask of absolute grief and regret. He threw his head back and screamed in anguish as he raised the knife.
Robert Langdon and Agent Simpkins arrived breathless outside the Temple Room doors as a blood-curdling scream erupted from within.
It was Peter's voice. Langdon was certain. Peter's cry was one of absolute agony.
I'm too late.
Ignoring Simpkins, Langdon seized the handles and yanked open the doors. The horrific scene before him confirmed his worst fears. There in the center of the dimly lit chamber, the silhouette of a man with a shaved head stood at the great altar. He wore a black robe and his hand was clutching a large blade. Before Langdon could move, the man was driving the knife down toward the body that lay outstretched on the altar. Malach had closed his eyes.
So beautiful. So perfect.
The ancient blade of the Akeda knife had glinted in the moonlight as it arched over him. Scented wisps of smoke had spiraled upward above him, preparing a pathway for his soon-to-be-liberated soul. His killer's lone scream of torment and desperation still rang through the sacred space as the knife came down.
I am besmeared with the blood of human sacrifice and parents' tears.
Malach braced for the glorious impact.
His moment of transformation had arrived. Incredibly, he felt no pain. A thunderous vibration filled his body, deafening and deep. The room began shaking, and a brilliant white light blinded him from above. The heavens roared, and Malach knew it had happened, exactly as he had planned. Langdon did not remember sprinting toward the altar as the helicopter appeared overhead, nor did he remember leaping with his arms outstretched, soaring toward the man in the black robe, trying desperately to tackle him before he could plunge the knife down a second time. Their bodies collided, and Langdon saw a bright light sweep down through the oculus and illuminate the altar. He expected to see the bloody body of Peter Solomon on the altar, but the naked chest that shone in the light had no blood on it at all, only a tapestry of tattoos. The knife lay broken beside him, apparently having been driven into the stone altar rather than into flesh. As he and the man in the black robe crashed together onto the hard stone floor, Langdon saw the bandaged nub on the end of the man's right arm, and he realized to his bewilderment that he had just tackled Peter Solomon. As they slid together across the stone floor, the helicopter's searchlights blazed down from above. The chopper thundered in low, its skids practically touching the expansive wall of glass. On the front of the helicopter, a strange-looking gun rotated, aiming downward through the glass. The red beam of its laser scope sliced through the skylight and danced across the floor, directly toward Langdon and Solomon.
No!
But there was no gunfire from above. Only the sound of the helicopter blades. Langdon felt nothing but an eerie ripple of energy that shimmered through his cells. Behind his head on the pigskin chair, the laptop hissed strangely. He spun in time to see its screen suddenly flash to black. Unfortunately, the last visible message had been clear. Sending message. 100% complete.
Pull up, damn it, up!
The UH-60 pilot threw his rotors into overdrive, trying to keep his skids from touching any part of the large glass skylight. He knew the 6,000 pounds of lift force that surged downward from his rotors was already straining the glass to its breaking point. Unfortunately, the incline of the pyramid beneath the helicopter was efficiently shedding the thrust sideways, robbing him of lift.
Up! Now!
He tipped the nose, trying to skim away. But the left strut hit the center of the glass. It was only for an instant, but that was all it took. The Temple Room's massive oculus exploded in a swirl of glass and wind, sending a torrent of jagged shards plummeting into the room below.
Stars falling from heaven.
Malach stared up into the beautiful white light and saw a veil of shimmering jewels fluttering toward him, accelerating, as if racing to shroud him in their splendor.
Suddenly, there was pain. Everywhere. Stabbing, searing, slashing. Razor-sharp knives piercing soft flesh. Chest, neck, thighs, face.
His body tightened all at once,
recoiling. His blood-filled mouth cried out as the pain ripped him from his trance. The white light above transformed itself, and suddenly, as if by magic, a dark helicopter was suspended above him, its thundering blades driving an icy wind down into the temple room, chilling Moloch to the core and dispersing the wisps of incense to the distant corners of the room. Moloch turned his head and saw the Akeda knife lying broken by his side, smashed upon the granite altar, which was covered in a blanket of shattered glass.
"Even after everything I did to him," Peter Solomon averted the knife. "He refused to spill my blood."
With welling horror, Moloch raised his head and peered down along the length of his own body.
This living artifact was to have been his great offering, but it lay in tatters. His body was drenched in blood, huge shards of glass protruding from his flesh in all directions.
Weakly, Moloch lowered his head back to the granite altar and stared up through the open space in the roof. The helicopter was gone now, in its place a silent, wintry moon. Wide-eyed, Moloch lay gasping for breath.
All alone, on the great altar.
Chapter 122.
The secret is how to die.
Moloch knew it had all gone wrong. There was no brilliant light, no wondrous reception, only darkness and excruciating pain, even in his eyes. He could see nothing, and yet he sensed movement all around him. There were voices, human voices. One of them, strangely, belonging to Robert Langdon.
"How can this be?"
"She's okay," Langdon kept repeating. "Catherine is fine, Peter. Your sister is okay."
"No,"
Moloch thought.
"Catherine is dead. She must be."
Moloch could no longer see, could not tell if his eyes were even open, but he heard the helicopter banking away. An abrupt calm settled through the temple room. Moloch could feel the smooth rhythms of the earth becoming uneven, as if the ocean's natural tides were being disrupted by a gathering storm. "Cao ab ordo." Unfamiliar voices were shouting now, talking urgently with Langdon about the laptop and video file.
"It's too late," Moloch knew. "The damage is done."
By now the video was spreading like wildfire into every corner of a shocked world, destroying the future of the Brotherhood.
"Those most capable of spreading the wisdom must be destroyed."
The ignorance of mankind is what helped the chaos grow. The absence of light on earth is what nourished the darkness that awaited Moloch.
"I have done great deeds, and soon I will be received as a king."
Moloch sensed that a lone individual had quietly approached. He knew who it was. He could smell the sacred oils he had rubbed into his father's shaved body.
"I don't know if you can hear me,"
Peter Solomon whispered in his ear,
"but I want you to know something."
He touched a finger to the sacred spot atop Moloch's skull.
"What you wrote here."
He paused. "This is not the last word."
"Of course it is,"
Moloch thought.
"You convinced me of that beyond a doubt."
According to legend, the last word was written in a language so ancient and arcane that mankind had all but forgotten how to read it. This mysterious language, Peter had revealed, was in fact the oldest language on earth.
"The language of symbols."
In the idiom of symbology, there was one symbol that reigned supreme above all others, the oldest and most universal. This symbol fused all the ancient traditions in a single solitary image that represented the illumination of the Egyptian sun god, the triumph of alchemical gold, the wisdom of the philosopher's stone, the purity of the Rosicrucian rose, the moment of creation, the all, the dominance of the astrological sun, and even the omniscient all-seeing eye that hovered atop the unfinished pyramid.
"The circumpunct, the symbol of the source, the origin of all things."
This is what Peter had told him moments ago. Moloch had been skeptical at first, but then he had looked again at the grid, realizing that the image of the pyramid was pointing directly at the lone symbol of the circumpunct, a circle with a dot in its center.
"The Masonic pyramid is a map," he thought, recalling the legend, "which points to the last word.
It seemed his father was telling the truth after all.
All great truths are simple.
The lost word is not a word.
It is a symbol.
Eagerly, Malak had inscribed the great symbol of the circumpunct on his scalp. As he did so, he felt an upwelling of power and satisfaction.
My masterpiece and offering are complete.
The forces of darkness were waiting for him now. He would be rewarded for his work. This was to be his moment of glory. And yet, at the last instant, everything had gone horribly wrong. Peter was still behind him now, speaking words that Malak could barely fathom.
I lied to you, he was saying.
You left me no choice. If I had revealed to you the true lost word, you would not have believed me, nor would you have understood.
The lost word is not the circumpunct?
The truth is, said Peter, the lost word is known to all, but recognized by very few. The words echoed in Malak's mind.
You remain incomplete, Peter said, gently placing his palm on top of Malak's head. Your work is not yet done. But wherever you are going, please know this. You were loved.
For some reason, the gentle touch of his father's hand felt like it was burning through him, like a potent catalyst that was initiating a chemical reaction inside Malak's body. Without warning, he felt a rush of blistering energy surging through his physical shell, as if every cell in his body were now dissolving. In an instant, all of his worldly pain evaporated.
Transformation. It's happening. I am gazing down upon myself, a wreck of bloody flesh on the sacred slab of granite. My father is kneeling behind me, holding my lifeless head with his one remaining hand. I feel an upwelling of rage and confusion. This is not a moment for compassion. It is for revenge, for transformation. And yet still my father refuses to submit, refuses to fulfill his role, refuses to channel his pain and anger through the knife blade and into my heart. I am trapped here, hovering, tethered to my earthly shell. My father gently runs a soft palm across my face, to close my fading eyes. I feel the tether release. A billowing veil materializes around me, thickening and dimming the light, hiding the world from view. Suddenly time accelerates, and I am plunging into an abyss far darker than any I have ever imagined. Here in the barren void I hear a whispering. I sense a gathering force. It strengthens, mounting at a startling rate, surrounding me. Ominous and powerful, dark and commanding. I am not alone here. This is my triumph, my grand reception. And yet, for some reason, I am filled not with joy, but rather with boundless fear. It is nothing like I expect. The force is churning now, swirling around me with commanding strength, threatening to tear me apart. Suddenly, without warning, the blackness gathers itself like a great prehistoric beast and rears up before me. I am facing all the dark souls who have gone before. I am screaming in infinite terror as the darkness swallows me whole.
Chapter 123. Inside the National Cathedral, Dean Galloway sensed a strange change in the air. He was not sure why, but he felt as if a ghostly shadow had evaporated, as if a weight had been lifted, far away and yet right here. Alone at his desk, he was deep in thought. He was not sure how many minutes had passed when his phone rang. It was Warren Bellamy.
"Peter's alive," his Masonic brother said. "I just heard the news. I knew you'd want to know immediately. He's going to be okay."
"Thank God," Galloway exhaled. "Where is he?"
Galloway listened as Bellamy recounted the extraordinary tale of what had transpired after they had left Cathedral College.
"But all of you are okay?"
"Recuperating, yes," Bellamy said. "There is one thing, though."
He paused.
"Yes?"
"The Masonic Pyramid. I think Langdon may have solved it."
Galloway had to smile. Somehow he was not surprised. And tell me, did Langdon discover whether or not the pyramid kept its promise? Whether or not it revealed what legend always claimed it would reveal?
I don't know yet.
It will, Galloway thought. You need to rest.
As do you.
No, I need